You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, welcome to the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. This is being recorded on the 19th of August, 2023. And as many of you know, newcomers might not, I am always in need of and accepting donations on the website, whether it be rustjournal.org or theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com. Russian Orthodox Medievalist button, the graphic there, or my Patreon page, many other things. It's all on the, should be in the description. And the website, all over, Radio Albion, of course. And I appreciate those of you who are regularly contributing in one form or another. And that's, it's humbling. Tonight I want to talk about Greek nationalism. This has been an on-again, off-again concern of mine. Now I'm talking about modern Greece. We're talking about 20th century Greece. Back in 2018, I think, I did a lecture on Ioannis Metaxas, who was a nationalist leader of Greece, who took over in a coup along with the monarch in 1936. A long time ago, I published, but have not spoken of, at least not on Radio Albion, the Greek military junta of 1967 and 1974. And I really just came up with this fairly recently, that they're very similar. They're very similar in their causes, and they're very similar in their effects. Metaxas, you know, the phenomenon of so-called fascism or various forms of anti-communist nationalism in Europe during the Great Depression in the 1930s, they're quite different from each other. Franco, Metaxas, Salazar, Hitler, these are very different men with very different agendas, but they do have a handful of things in common. I don't think Hitler was a fascist in Mussolini's sense. National socialism and fascism of the Italian version are very different from each other. But Americans aren't very good at fine distinctions. Now, Metaxas is slightly better known than the Greek junta. And as I mentioned, and I think that's the voice of reason, I did the Greek military government in the late 60s and early 70s. Very little, of course, has been done, at least in English, defending or even understanding either one of these situations. Metaxas, the Metaxas lecture I did years ago, I have substantially rewritten and improved and expanded the paper that's upon which that's based. So there's going to be minimal overlap, but I'm dealing with both periods of time here, and I'll start with Metaxas first. 1871 to 1941. He came to power in the midst of the Depression, specifically 1936. In both cases, both 1968 and 1936, the social context was very similar. Severely divided country politically, controversies over the monarchy, controversies over the direction of Greek life. There was the so-called national schism, which we'll mention in a bit. Officially promoted liberalism, especially financed by Great Britain. And a right wing that simply had enough. Parliaments don't function in times of chaos. They usually can't. Liberal democracy is a cover for oligarchy. In the first third of the 20th century, Metaxas and many others like him represented the royalist and nationalist faction in Greek politics. There's really only two major ones. But before he took over, now we're talking about right after the Balkan Wars, just before World War I, one of the more outrageous things that the British did, is, you know, the Entente in general, was to try to get Greece to fight for them. And Metaxas, of course, who was involved in the modernization of the Greek army prior to World War I, was one of the leaders opposed to joining the war at all on either side. His opposition, and he has an equivalent in the late 60s, Euthylios Venizelos, who died in 1936, which is probably not a coincidence. He was the head of the Liberal Party, financed by Great Britain, and he functioned really only from British sponsorship. Both factions had officers in the army supporting them, but Venizelos attempted to convince the country that after two bloody Balkan wars, let alone the Wars of Independence earlier, that entering into World War I was a good idea. And he wanted to defend, in fact, an allied campaign in the Dardanelles Strait, connecting the Sea of Marmara with the Aegean. The battle over World War I was the start of the national schism. It's a result of the Allied demands for Greek action against the Central Power. So the monarchy, the nationalists, and the church sought neutrality. Metaxas, having been trained in Germany, was seen as a Germanophile. Venizelos and the liberals were used by Britain to force the country into the war. Now, like liberals everywhere, they care about power and they don't care how they get it. He was installed as dictator in 1910 and then proceeded to ban all political parties, forcing free trade policies of in London's interest. The Gaudi coup in 1909, he was appointed prime minister directly from that, which came from the Military League, which was a modernist anti-royalist group that wanted close relations with the UK. And as a sole candidate, he was elected the chief executive. The nationalists were always disorganized and divided. The liberal faction barely won in 1915, although there were many accusations of fraud. But very quickly, Venizelos and his faction were dismissed by the crown. His dismissal was one of the things that solidified the rift between monarchists on the one side and liberals on the other. Several times, the liberals were charged with electoral fraud. Clearly, no one wanted to enter into World War I. But of course, this is a much earlier than that. But Venizelos was used by British intelligence to overthrow the monarchy. Of course, Greece to come directly under British financial control actually occurred for a short time. But to bring all of Europe together in free trade policies, having their two opponents, Germany and Russia, fight each other. Britain allied with Russia in 1914 only to set them on the Germans. London hated all things Russian. But neutrality was very popular. 1916, Venizelos openly condemned the crown as pro-German at a rally. And what ended up happening is that the British financed Venizelos and his faction to create a new separatist government in Salonika, Thessaloniki, a huge, very wealthy port city. And he called it the Provisional Government of National Defense. And its sole reason for existing was to facilitate Greece's entry into the war. He claimed that this was a defensive move against the Bulgarians, who were part of the Central Powers. They had fought each other in the Second Balkan War. But Bulgaria's wars against its neighbors were very unpopular at home. both Greece, I mean, really all the Balkans, Greece, Bulgaria, Serbia, were exhausted. They had been fighting pretty much for the whole of the 20th century at this point. The British were promising everyone the moon so long as they fought for them. So it wasn't a defense against Bulgaria. Bulgaria was already promised Greek territory if they sided with them. But there were anti-war demonstrations both in Bulgaria as well as Greece. And there were plenty of army officers speaking out against the Thessaloniki government, their unbending support for Britain, and had a great degree of reluctance to enter into another war in Europe. The British went so far as to demand the government be totally dethroned. The French threatened Greece with invasion unless they fought for the Allies. And the crown said no, and the army was ready to stand with him. An Allied invasion, in fact, was expected, and Greece was purely neutral. But, you know, London and Paris really thought that the liberals were more popular and powerful than they really were. There was a small detachment landed in Athens on December 1st, 1916, but it was met with strong resistance. They were eventually evacuated the next day. There was a nationalist riot against the Venizelos movement. Again, something else that solidified the national schism. And afterwards, the Allies recognized the government that they created. Venizelos stayed in Salonika. The king, of course, and the army rejected it entirely. The British then proceeded to blockade the major ports. And again, the British demanded the resignation of the monarch because he refused to place the country at London's disposal. Of course, they promised, you know, territorial concessions and everything. But none of that was honest. And in many cases, the British were in no position to grant any of this. Constantine then left office because the blockade was very serious. And he took many supporters with him to Italy. And only then could Venizelos come to Athens and take over. So in 1920, after the war, the royalists and nationalists were elected by huge margins. In fact, Venizelos couldn't even get himself elected to parliament. And the result is that the Allies secretly sided with Turkey during the Greco-Turkish War in 1919-1922, which led to the Greek defeat. This would have been now the fourth deadly war of the 20th century, and it's 1919. And so it was a deliberate, you know, they exposed the Greek forces in Asia Minor on purpose, pulled away from the area, leaving the exhausted Greeks exposed. And because the liberals were destroyed in the election and the Greek army was purged, France and Italy concluded secret agreements with the Young Turk revolutionaries. And, of course, the Western-backed Bolshevik government of you know, the USSR was very friendly to the Turkish revolutionaries. The Soviet Union was the main supplier of both money and weapons. Somehow, Bolsheviks sent 442 pounds of gold, despite the fact that they were living in mass famine. Where did that gold come from? Building up the Young Turks in Turkey was a way to punish Greece. And London had a huge amount of leverage over the new post-Ottoman Turkey. So the ploy was to leave the Greeks alone and have them defeated, and hence to discredit the nationalists in Athens. 1923, there was the infamous population transfer. Greeks living in areas under Turkish control were sent back to Greece, and vice versa. And then Britain used a handful of generals to engage in a coup right afterwards, and then persecuted their opponents. And then things changed in 1929. The Greek economy collapsed, and Venizelos, in power with British money at the time, declared martial law because there was quite a bit of popular anger against him. Very high rate of employment, and agitators were everywhere. Usury had taken over the countryside. Falling incomes forced people to resort to credit, which is another way of saying that more and more property was falling into the hands of Venizelist oligarchs. Not to mention they had hundreds of thousands of ethnic Greek refugees from Asia Minor, uprooted after the Greco-Turkish War and the population transfer, and they were still living as refugees in 1929. Greece couldn't service its very large foreign debt by the early 30s. So the post-war Allied movement really was a collection agency. The British said that they're not going to be getting any loans unless it became a financial colony of London. And in 1932, the Greek central bank came directly under British control. And it shouldn't surprise you that the liberal coalition fell to pieces, both whether it be nationalists or liberals. Whether or not these elections were fair, it doesn't matter, but they both could barely function. This is typical of parliamentary governments before military coups in Latin America and in Europe at the time. Free trade, which Britain had imposed on the country using the Liberal Party, it just meant mass poverty, because Greek employers then closed their doors in the face of British competition. At the same time, usury is taking advantage of a desperate population, and their property was falling into the hands of their creditors. At this point, the government of Venizelos declared bankruptcy for the fourth time, and he couldn't maintain control anymore, and he relinquished power in mid-1932, where the nationalists came back to power. And because of all of these factions and foreign intrigue, the nationalists had a real tough time putting a functional government together. But the number of governments that came and went, Papanastasiou government functioned from May 26th to June 5th of 1932. Venizelos took over again until the 3rd of November of that year. Another government fell in January 16th, 1933. Venizelos comes back again and ruled until March 6th. From March 6th to the 10th, the Prime Minister of Greece was Othonios. March 10th to October 10th, 1935, Sadatis became prime minister again. It went back and forth, one group after another, as the country continues to plunge into poverty. This is almost comic. This is what democracy was to Greeks at this point. And it existed because the Allies and their banks thought that they can control it through their oversight, really, of the Greek banking establishment. But liberalism was widely seen as a miserable failure. Political parties were seen as just fronts. There was another British-inspired coup in 1933 by General Nicholas Palaiologos to reinstate Venizelos in power. But in 1935, of course, the Nationalists won the election again, and there was some kind of... and this was, I think, the last election. The Venizelists, when they knew they couldn't win, they had a tendency to just boycott the election rather than go down to defeat. By that point, a rump parliament had declared the restoration of the monarchy. They won a referendum in this regard with 97% wanting the reigning monarch, then King George, the son of Constantine. Now, 97% seems high, but that's because the liberals, on orders from London and the USSR, were told to boycott that election too, in this case a referendum. They feared another loss at the polls. So he returned to Greece in 1935. King George tried to pardon. He tried to, those who attempted the coup, tried to fix the national schism, but... Thank God by that time, Venizelos was elderly. He retired to Paris, and he died in 1936. And, he was a Mason. He called himself the Demiurgos of Greece, which is straight out of the Masonic Arcana. He is this, your typical French revolutionary. Free trade, really, in his mind was, in reality, a code phrase for British control. And he was used by London to keep Athens from siding with Germany at any time. He created the Greek Stock Exchange, this kind of thing, and foreign capital came to dominate the country. I should actually say the 1936 election was the very last one, the last before the war, and yet again, another deadlock. And by this time, something had changed, and that was the introduction of Stalin's Communist Party. They won 15 seats, and despite the total deadlock between the two factions meant that 15 seats was enough to sway a parliamentary vote on something. But by this time, no one was taking this seriously. From Metaxas, as this is all going on, he's cultivating a close relationship with the royal house. He understood how liberalism works. The monarch, King George, was searching for someone, an anti-communist, anti-leftist, strong enough to bind together a working coalition, but not so strong that he would be able to dictate to the crown itself. He tried to send the parliament home for good, and his government was called the 4th of August movement in 1936, because that's the date of his takeover. But 1936 was an extremely difficult year. Labor unrest was everywhere. Metaxas had no choice but to declare a state of emergency and dissolve parliament, really for an indefinite period. Venizelos had done the same thing, and he did it more than once. But this was the last option. His rule was the last chance Greece had to continue to function. He did have strong working class support, because it was Venizelos and the liberals who had outlawed unionization, who had outlawed any sense of labor union or even strikes. Now, despite the fact that the communists could get very few seats at any given time, there was a massive number of strikes between 35 and 36. They didn't even have a bad case, but because you had communist entryism there, the government was very, very worried about it. And the ham-handed, in May of 1936, is of course prior to Metaxas' coup, 5,000, actually it was May 8th, 5,000 tobacco workers in Thessaloniki struck and went to the governor's office, and unfortunately the National Guard killed a few people. And the only thing that did was increase the support for the strikes. Actually, all told, in this period of time, 12 were killed and 32 were injured. In the financial hub of Thessaloniki, there was no government that functioned at all. And this is why Metaxas took over. But this is very typical, both economically, in terms of the utter failure of politicians to do anything. In fact, there was going to be a nationwide strike with strong communist representation on the 5th of August. And that's why he chose the 4th of August to take over. And of course, he ruled entirely in the king's name. The liberals had abandoned the gold standard, for better or for worse, but for whatever the purpose, it led to great monetary instability. 1932, a few years earlier, inflation became a huge problem. Industrial production fell. Real incomes fell. Interest rates went up, and the unemployment rate, obviously. I mean, exports fell by half between 1929 and 1932. The state was almost disintegrated by 1936. But what does Metaxas say? He takes over. The 4th of August government is in power. Someone's finally doing something. But here's what he says, one of his first speeches. "We must subordinate our appetites, our passions, and our egotism to the wholeness of the national interest. This way we'll be a really free people. Otherwise, anarchy and indiscipline will reign over us under the false mask of freedom. Democracy, the system of the ancient Athenian society, is characterized by mediocrity. The leaders of the democratic regimes are only mediocre human beings, servants of the sovereign masses. While what societies need are superior beings to lead their nations, democracy derives its strength from amorphous and a misguided mass." Now, the truth of the matter is that the masked man was the creation of modern capitalism, but it serves the moneyed interests, plutocracy, rather than mass society. Mass society is a consequence, is a conclusion. But politicians don't normally speak like this. Metaxas is from a poor family, like many military rulers, but he could trace his lineage back to a Byzantine-era aristocratic family. He was very sympathetic to the laboring classes. And really, the 4th of August government's objectives come down to repudiating the old capitalist system and replacing it with some kind of corporatist integralism. integralism. National solidarity rather than the egocentrism that capitalism unleashes, especially when that capitalism takes the form, as it usually does, of rent-seeking and usury. You know, corporatism is something that I've spoken of here many times. I've talked about the Charter of Kanata, Gabriel D'Annunzio. I've talked about Hegel and corporatism. And I mentioned the what's called the Constitution of Fiume, the Charter of Kanata, same thing, written in 1920, which provided an alternative to capitalism and socialism. The way that D'Annunzio laid it out, he had 9 guilds: industrial, agricultural workers, seafarers, businessmen, industrial and agricultural technicians, etc. And however it's organized really doesn't matter, so long as it's representative. But the concept is that they have to cooperate towards moral ends. They have to follow the same language, basic customs and religion. The underlying unity is the state. The term is used a bit differently in continental Europe than in the Anglo-American world. And remember, you have the Soviet Union, who wants a piece of Greece, and that was the case throughout the 20th century. But they're in a time of total disintegration. Everything, in Metaxas' mind, constituted part of the state. It's the collective will manifest in these corporations, such as representative unions. It transcended the present egotistical interest. That of Venizelos and the British had introduced an alien system of thought on Greece. And that's why his first speech is saying we need to control the passions and control the ego. That's the only way for a country to be free, that is to say, independent and autonomous. Freedom can never be defined as mere self-will, because that turns into simply the following of the passions. It's an insidious form of slavery, despite the fact that both Marxism and capitalism claim that that is actually human nature. It's nothing but lower passions. They rationalize the servility to these lower non-rational drives, fashion, social pressure. Free cooperation with the national whole, where your labor becomes fully national through the guild, is one of the great strengths of corporatism. And various aspects of this were already slowly being put into practice, would be in Spain and Germany and Italy. I want to quote Metaxas again here. And in that very same speech, August 4th, 1936, he's talking about the parliament, and he says, which was elected in January of 36, after the nation's long internal struggles in trying to restore internal peace to the country proved incapable and incompetent from the very start, due to the incurable party antagonisms, personal quarrels, which were of little interest to the majority of the working people, communism, taking advantage of the situation and the support given to it by various political parties, raised the head of what he called the apostasy. Then he says the government found itself under the immediate threat of social and national destruction, and considering it an imperative duty to prevent the manifestation of subversion, for the suppression, which blood could certainly flow in abundance, proceeded to approve His Majesty the King's declaration of martial law. He continues and said, to this end, I ask everyone for complete discipline towards the state for the salvation of Greek society. And of course, the point of that he's trying to make is that the obedience to the whole, the national will, is necessary for any kind of society to function, individual or collective. And he says at the very end, he says, any reaction against the national work of Greek Renaissance, I am determined to neutralize it by the harshest means. He was a populist, and actually in the 1930s, the major right-wing party was a populist party, because they did stand for a fair distribution of wealth, which was completely skewed by 1936. But even, you know, the old Italian corporatism, a corporation is a legal entity and is so recognized by the state. It has its own assembly and distributes its economic work. And as the 4th of August government developed, corporatism became more clearly the new tendency of government. He called it the cooperative structuring of society into a system of national delegations. And he created the Great Council of National Labor and the Assembly of Professions, serving as a body of these corporations. But Metaxas, it wasn't the liberals before him. He was the one who, because he now ruled as an authoritarian leader, he forced through the minimum wage, unemployment insurance, the public employment agency. He instituted maternity leave, a 5-day, 40-hour work week, and guaranteed 2-week vacations with pay or 2 weeks double pay in its place, and very stricter work safety standards. He created the Workers' Center to look after workers' housing and recreation. And that was enforced by 1939. The same thing was going on in Germany and in Italy. Wages increased on average by 50% in Greece between 1935 and 1940. Although inflation did take a bite out of that, real increase was 5% a year, which, of course, was superior to anything else that came before. The Greek government succeeded in reducing unemployment, and this is actual total people out of work, 1.2 million by the time he took over, and he reduced it to 26,000 during his first years in power. 1939, it was about 15,000. And part of the reason for this is he began to trade vigorously with Germany. He did stabilize the drachma, the Greek currency. He did bring inflation under control. And very much like Hitler, he engaged in a huge public works program, land drainage, the construction of railways, road improvements, and modernization of telecommunications. But you saw rising incomes. And I think his most important reform, the cancellation of debt, something that, of course, Venizelos could never do. Huge debt relief all over the place, canceling debts on peasant families especially, and condemning usury out in the open. Because he saw the agricultural classes as the first and direct creators of value. They were pouring into the cities because usurers were taking over their land, and he reversed this. And he made sure that they had a firm title to their land. He created something called peasant houses. These are agricultural cooperatives, actually put together by 1939, which is part of his overall economic reform program. Understand, none of this was even discussed in the decade prior to this. Improving irrigation, alleviating indebtedness was the big one. Distributing wasteland. Greece doesn't have a lot of arable land, so this is extremely important. For the first time, Greek imports did not exceed export. You had a huge outflow of money prior to this. He put together the Central Committee for the Protection of Domestic Wheat Production. 60% of food was grown in Greece, which, again, without a lot of arable land, is not easy to do. And they could buy out their tenancies with cheap state loans at pretty much zero interest, which were supposed to be forgiven at some point. Anyway, full title deeds were granted. And the production of wheat went from, in 1936, it was 531,000 tons, a million tons in 1938. As I said, 60% of domestic consumer needs were being met by Greek farmers. 1938, exports went up 57% over the previous year. And the same thing for the currency reserves. And everything from industrial output to electricity and other utilities went up ridiculously. Economic activity went up 138% between 1936 and 1938. But he could only do this because he took over and he didn't have to answer to anyone but the crown. He did what the communists only promised, and of course their promises never came to pass since they don't believe in private property. He banned strikes, but only because he went beyond the demands of even the most extreme strikers. He banned child labor. Mandatory Sunday holidays. You couldn't do business then. Healthcare was increased massively. Unfortunately, this all came to an end on October 28th, 1940, because Benito Mussolini, a buffoon, without telling Hitler, without telling anybody, decided to invade Greece. Of course, he was badly defeated, and his reputation never recovered. The only problem with this was that because it was Italy, that meant that Greece automatically was with the Allies. That was, you know, not something that Metaxas necessarily wanted. But he was a Germanophile, and their economic growth did have a lot to do with trade with Germany. But because Italy, out of nowhere, and really for no good reason, invaded Greece from their bases in Albania, all of this came to an end. And it really didn't matter because he died in January of 1941. And, you know, Mussolini was such a bad military leader. He wasn't a military man. Supreme commanders, it was a revolving door. It took a month for this huge army of Albanians and Italians to be pushed back with huge losses. And it's a shame only because so many Italians were killed. If Mussolini had not destroyed this, who knows what Metaxas could have done. He may well have been another Francisco Franco. Of course, after the war, things went back to how they were because it was both a liberal and a communist victory. Now, we're talking about a different era. After the war, of course, Greece was a huge battleground between Stalin and Greek tradition. Nothing had changed with the national schism, except the leftist side got far worse. These weren't Mensheviks, these were Stalinists. Greece, again, was in the fight for its life. A civil war broke out between Greek patriots and the Stalin-backed rebels, only ended in 1949. And the same thing that led to Metaxas taking over occurred in the post-war era. Inflation skyrocketed, massive discontent. Of course, the Stalinists were funded from abroad, both from Yugoslavia and the USSR. And Greece was considered a major prize for Stalin. It was strategically located, possessed great natural wealth. And he was aware that the U.S. supported his expansion and was financing Stalin's reindustrialization. But the Greek anti-communists defeated Stalin's forces in 1949. And eventually, of course, they were banned. And the Western governments were condemning this persecution of the communists. But the Greek military, just like it was in the 20s and 30s, for the most part, a conservative institution, the top brass, and even especially the rank of colonel, lieutenant colonel, and colonel, was even more right-wing than the generals, because many of them did cut their teeth fighting Stalin and his imperial designs. You had conservative governments in the early 1960s. The National Radical Union was a popular anti-communist party then. And the equivalent to Venizelos was George Papandreou, Sr. And this is after, you know, the assassination of, got even more pompous, George Lambrakis. One of these idiots, these guys who claims to be a pacifist, but he had no difficulty with violence if his enemies were the ones that were losing. He had no problem with Stalin's aggression. But just like a couple decades earlier, his funeral led to huge leftist demonstrations. Parties were financed by London, and they wanted a more liberal parliament. These communist groups began rioting in Greece, and the Western regime, of course, was up to something here. They were talking about the Aquarian Age and liberal democracy being brought to Greece here. And there was a constitutional crisis where liberals now running Greece clash with another king, Constantine II. With a few defections from Papandreou's side, the king could bring down that government. But just like in the 30s and 20s, it was very difficult to form a nationalist government just on its own. Papandreou wanted nothing to do with Greek tradition. He hated the monarchy. It was his fault that there was a constitutional crisis because he went on tirades against it. And in Greek politics at the time, it was understood that the king had full charge of the army, which in and of itself with the left was a problem. But since most leftist governments come to power through force and violence, you know, they attempted to purge the army. A conservative army was absolutely out of the question. A constitutional crisis needed to be provoked to destroy the monarchy and thus bring the army under their control. Papandreou, in a fit of anger, demanded to be appointed defense minister. The army always being a thorn in the left side. He packed the army and purged it. He promoted officers who supported him in liberalism. And then he, and then finally the king got rid of him. And Papandreou ended up resigning as prime minister. Again, liberal democracy failed. Again, this weak state under people like Papandreou it not only could not do anything against this, but in fact was financing this. But even the monarch's government couldn't stand either. Things were split so badly. The state was paralyzed again, very similar to 1934, 1935. A few of the liberal defectors were coming to the mid-late 60s here. You had an almost exactly 50-50 split in the legislature. Papandreou was just like Venizelos, extremely arrogant, viewed himself as the enlightened one, was called upon to bring civilization to the Greeks. No government could get a vote of confidence. And because of all this, the Greek economy continued to suffer. You know, that crazy cycle of governments that I mentioned a few minutes ago, well, in 1967, governments were lasting about a week. And exactly like you had in the early 30s. And Greece is sinking into poverty and yet again hyperinflation. The parallels between the first half of the 1930s and what we have here in 65 to 67 are so perfect that obviously it's not a coincidence. The liberals then made an alliance with the Stalinists. The military had banned, the conservative governments had banned the Stalinist movement. So they regrouped and they called it the Socialist Party. I mean, largely because, you know, the Soviet Union was supporting this party openly. Of course, Stalin was long dead. But the fact that those who were trying to actually destroy Greece and bring it into the Soviet orbit now had a full backing of liberals and the Papandreou movement. So the communist threat, yet again, was very real. You know, they didn't have tons of support, but it doesn't matter. You don't need that many people to cause a lot of problems. By 1967, we know what Marxism was doing in China, what Marxism had done in the Soviet Union. In fact, 1967 was right in the middle of the Cultural Revolution. And eventually, just like in 1936, it led to a coup. Democracy had failed miserably again. Split population, politicians lying to everybody, claiming they're for something and they're not. No one really knew what they were voting for. A massive decline in public morals, failing economy, strikes, street protests, squabbling politicians, pompous speech making, institutionalized lying, threats, endless provocations, and all kinds of other problems created by a democratic system. People realized that politicians couldn't do anything. The coup took place in April of 1967. Just short of elections that everyone knew were going to be inconsequential. And they were very popular. Arrogant politicians were arrested en masse. And really, and I want to make a point here, the officers, the highest ranking really were two colonels and lower ranks than that. And that I don't think is an accident. Marazios was the first colonel. And of course, George Papadopoulos was the undisputed leader, and eventually they had a general, Brigadier General Patakos. But he was a fairly minor figure, despite formally outranking these guys. These men, also from poverty, populist by conviction, and making it very clear that the political crisis there was created by corrupt politicians and bankers out of touch with Greek life. This was felt by the overwhelming majority of the population. And it also happens to be true, and the monarch fully agreed with all of this. But Papadopoulos was considered fairly young, though the colonels respected the institution of monarchy in general. But these mid-level officers, they were from peasant stock. They looked at urbanization with utter disdain. The politicians and the bankers who ran this dying economy and dying political system were all urbanites, and many of them foreign. And there was a propaganda war. And unfortunately, the left has always been better at that. The chief of the army was the first man to be arrested, and he was a very cosmopolitan figure. And of course, the U.S. immediately condemned the coup. They called it a rape of democracy. But all that means is that they recognized that the military was at war with liberalism. Upper brass didn't like this coup. Lower level officers did. Politicians of all stripes condemned this. Colonels eventually arrested the generals. That was a political move with many powerful social and economic effects. And it was simply to say that Greece is not going to tolerate plutocracy anymore. And the policies that they engaged in bore this out. The king was forced to legalize it. He was suspicious of it, but he eventually legalized it, which itself improved the military's image. But the monarchy, things had changed, and the relations between Papadopoulos and the monarchy were relatively poor, even though the colonels were monarchists in theory. In fact, several times the monarchy tried to get rid of them. Again, Salonika, Thessaloniki is involved. Constantine was to fly to the north with a military force loyal to him. The Navy and the Air Force actually supported the monarchy here. And just like Venizelos, the king wanted to create an alternative northern government and receive international recognition. But the army didn't go along. Lower-level officers were refusing the commands of loyal generals stationed right there. The king's plans failed. And this is, as I said, this is where the generals got arrested. Constantine went into exile. So you have a king that wasn't up to the task, who was taken in by British liberalism in a lot of ways. And pretty much at the time, and I've read the CIA circulars at the time, CIA money was placed on Constantine's movement. What American foreign policy tended to do is want banana republics that capital can manipulate. Finance capital does not like nationalist movements. So the regime usually places its bet on the center. You know, Duarte's party in El Salvador, Constantine in Greece. It comes from the same mentality. So the junta called itself the Revolutionary Council. And their opposition came from the U.S., the middle classes, you know, urban intellectuals, businessmen, and international finance. Their base was labor and agriculture especially. And then in the 1970s, Papadopoulos established a new constitution, making Greece a republic. And this is something different from the 1930s. But the king was, like so many, was a cosmopolitan rather than a nationalist. Now, what brought it down, ultimately, was the Turkish invasion of Cyprus. No different than Mussolini bringing Metaxas' government down. He couldn't engage in his reforms anymore, and then he died by invading Greece with Albania. And there's some people who believe, especially in Greece, that this was a NATO concept to destroy the council. The Greek junta did support nationalist paramilitaries in Cyprus. But as we now know, in 1973, oil had been discovered near Cyprus. So Israel, Turkey, and the U.S., liberals were mobilized to destroy the military government and, of course, throw Greece into third world status as it is right now. So you see the parallels are extraordinary. And it's the same thing over and over again. And it's similar also in the fact that they were successful governments. The Revolutionary Council, this is, they took this seriously. They were ideologically driven in the best sense. Greece was a dependent state because there was a small urban clique that was part of international finance. And then this, through usury, was the dispolation of labor and agriculture. The colonels remained consistently popular, with huge proportions of the population until the Turkish invasion of Cyprus, which I'm not going to get into. Papadopoulos was able to project a great image that appealed to many Greeks. Son of a poor family, he's from a rural area, and his only education was from the military academy. He did publicly condemn the elite usurers. The poor conservative religious farmers widely supported him. He had rough mannerisms. His speech was very lower class, quote unquote. Even George Papadopoulos is, I think, the most common name in Greece. Friend of the common man. And he knew that there was a connection between democracy and oligarchy. He talked about it all the time. However liberal democracy is imposed, usually by force, oligarchy is the result. So the 1967-73 period, in contrast to what had come before, and even, you know, liberal historians have to say this, was marked by high rates of economic growth, low inflation, and low unemployment. The tourist industry was developed, public spending. Incentives for Greek-owned businesses, especially small and medium-sized. He did permit some foreign capital. And this is why the council maintained the popularity of the general population. Another reason they were popular was the communists were thrown in prison by the thousands. Which is a very good idea, because, like communists everywhere, they were going to install a gulag system in Greece. They banned the hippie movement. Another elite-financed drive out of Harvard, and the junta was aware of this. And these hippie kids, they were drafted into the army. And this simple approach, this was part of his appeal. But under the oligarchy, you know, farming was a dangerous occupation. Farmers were going bankrupt in huge numbers. And of course, having the, you know, the usury was at the root of all of this. The conservatives who supported the king were not in any position to do anything about this. So the Revolutionary Council was National Socialists. And just like Metaxas, they canceled most agricultural debt. And they were very careful. Family farms, not the Western-owned combines. Because you had to say, what is the number of debt that's being written off? So 100,000 was what they were willing to work with. Yeah, it's a large sum, but it's too small for a large, you know, foreign combine. Direct support for struggling farmers was temporarily granted. It became easier for farming families to send their kids to college with no tuition. But the way it was seen at the time, college then was for the wealthy. They were mobilized and trained to riot by the communists and the leftists in general, condemning militarism. All their protest signs were in English. I've seen a bunch of pictures. Low-interest loans or zero-interest loans were granted by the junta all over the place. And, of course, they got all that money back. And unfortunately, it was the oil shock that negated a lot of these gains, not just the Turkish invasion. But that's no fault of the junta. Some public support was lost in 1974 because of all of these issues. Greece, under the junta, was going to back out of the U.S. liberal-dominated global trading order by making sure the Greek currency was unconvertible, so unaffected by so-called market pressures. That actually made Greece sovereign. Eventually, Papandreou took the helm in 1974. He was teaching at Harvard at the time, which shouldn't surprise you. First thing he did was render the currency floatable, hence vulnerable to outside manipulation. So the convertible currency floats with the U.S. dollar, which means it's under American control. Or a banker's control. It's no coincidence that you have these two similar, almost identical movements doing the same thing, coming from the same circumstance. The only big difference is the crown. It had become a cosmopolitan. It was vaguely conservative, which didn't mean much. Nationalism was not part of its vocabulary. The colonels were popular with the lower classes, and that's really all they wanted to represent. The fact that Papandreou went to teach at Harvard when he was overthrown, you know, gives you all the information you need to know. And the policies pursued by the military governments in both cases were successful. But as we close out here, I want to make a comment. One of my pet peeves is the almost universal belief that the U.S. supported military governments during the Cold War. I'm telling you this, the U.S. has never except possibly in the very beginning, ever backed a military government. And I don't know what they mean by backed. Well, they didn't put massive sanctions on them. They didn't invade them, necessarily. That doesn't mean they supported them. The Carter administration suspended trade with all Latin American states that came under the military. Pinochet was forbidden to enter the country. The CIA was sent to kill him. As always, the U.S. wanted moderate liberals to rule. Authoritarian right-wingers are bad for business. So the CIA's intelligence memorandum of January 19, 1968, very hostile to the Greek government. They demanded the government's overthrow. That the junta can never achieve its goals to get rid of corruption. And corruption is always in quotes, by the way. And in fact, NATO demanded that Greece be ejected from the alliance. It says that the CIA said that the junta was had replaced many local officials with military officers, and hence was a totalitarian system. Well, there were no sanctions on the USSR. And in fact, as a matter of rhetoric, Greece and the USSR were thrown in the same boat. Meaning that, of course, Marxism was never the issue in the U.S. It was the inability to control those economies, despite the fact that the USSR was largely financed by the U.S. There's a telegram from the Embassy of Greece to the Department of State, April of 67. They condemn the junta. They say what is essential here is that Greece pointed again in the direction of some kind of government with the consent of the governed. The point, of course, they're trying to make is that this government was not representative when the exact opposite was true. The U.S., of course, wanted to impose its own system. It's incredibly arrogant, the CIA's point of view, and they were this way for all military governments. I've dealt with the Indonesian case a couple of years ago. The CIA condemned every military government. It never occurred to them that the colonels may have been representative. The difference, I guess one of the differences in the Metaxas case is that because Italy invaded Greece, Metaxas had no choice but to accept assistance from Britain. But in both cases, had that not been the case, given what the British had done in the past in Greece, they wouldn't have supported him at all. They figured, okay, this is a way to take a bite out of Germany. In fact, the CIA is in favor of coups so long as their own guys are running it and liberalism and free trade is a result. The CIA memorandum, it says, a fiat government of a national constitutional council consisting of eminent jurists and others of unquestioned integrity and stature. That's what the CIA wanted to replace the military. They knew what the military government was. In both cases, it was populist. And it was dedicated to some variant of national socialism or social nationalism. The government that they wanted is one that is dependent on money. Military governments are not. Military men are not dependent on oligarchy. Military governments did not work with landlords, not large landlords anyway. Wherever you go, if you read my book on the Latin American military governments, they were condemned by the U.S. nonstop, and they actually delivered what the communists only promised. And in fact, it was so bad in places like Peru, you know, Velasco, one of my favorite all-time military leaders, the communists were involved in, as land was being distributed to peasants, communists were blowing things up because, of course, they don't believe in private property, but they were promising the same thing. But you see this everywhere. It's a ridiculous myth that the U.S. welcomed or backed in any explicit way military governments anywhere. No one bothers to read the CIA memoranda at the time. I've mentioned, I forget when I did the Indonesian thing, but it was front page, New York Times. CIA documents say that the U.S. supported Suharto's slaughter of the communists in 1966. Well, I actually read the CIA documents at the time, and they say the exact opposite. So they just assume that no one's going to bother to read them or even know where to get them, and so they could say whatever they want. It isn't true at all. That constant drumbeat, the U.S. supported anti-communist governments, they did not. If you could show me sanctions, I mean, the Afghan thing was a different story in 1980, but There were no sanctions on the Soviet Union, only nationalist governments. There were sanctions on Franco. The CIA was talking about overthrowing the colonels. Again, Metaxas, because of Italy, because Greece could be used, trying to keep it from Germany and Italy, it was a different story. At least there, Metaxas wanted neutrality, very much like Franco, and I think he followed Franco in that respect. And it was really the same thing here. Of course, they were clearly anti-communist, but they didn't trust the U.S. either. I mentioned the January 19th, 1968 thing was vehemently hostile to this government. That's the case for all military governments. The response to the Niger coup, which I've spoken of at great length, is the classic template CIA response to all military coups, at least those on the right. It's just something that if they figure if they repeat it enough, it's going to become just an article of faith. The U.S. vehemently condemned this coup. The U.S. and the Soviet Union had defeated nationalism and proceeded to divide up the world between the two of them. But the hostility, any kind of hostility between the two empires, had nothing to do with Marxism. It had to do with American trade privileges. An empire becoming too large. And both empires actually worried about the other getting too big. But ideology wasn't the issue. But ideology becomes the issue where nationalism and national socialism are concerned. In World War II, the U.S. had sanctions on Spain, but was financing the USSR. And I also have substantial research how the U.S. sided with North Korea against the South under the South Korean military government. And I go into great detail there. It's a long-standing myth, and it just shows how gullible American academics are and journalists are. But I mentioned the Indonesian case for this very same reason. They just make it up. So either they didn't read it or they didn't care. They needed their ideological justification, and so they made up a story. Of course, journalists do that all the time. These CIA memoranda, whether it be in Greece or in Indonesia or any of these military governments, are short, very easy to read, and they all say the same thing. The CIA wants its own coup, so long as it's a color revolution, that they could put free traders and bankers in power, usually educated in the West. If Papandreou was teaching in Harvard, and he was foreign educated anyway, it's always the same. The U.S. has violently condemned military governments everywhere. Everywhere. From Chiang Kai-shek to Chung Hee Park to Suharto to General Bashir, to the officers in Niger, everywhere in Latin America. They did not, quote-unquote, support them. They supported liberal parties everywhere. And the CIA documents, which I could produce in abundance, back me up on that. So, closing here. I think it is extremely significant that in Greece, in the late 30s, in this period of time, from 67 to 74, are extremely similar. Obviously, it's not a coincidence. And this is how the pro-British liberals on the one hand allied with the communists, and the nationalists and military on the other side, this is how the system has broken down. And given the debt situation, which is still raging in Greece, this may happen again. And having Greece leave NATO would not be a terrible thing, especially if they can make peace over Cyprus. Anyway, thank you for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.